From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You can start on the car lot. Last month, for the first time, Toyota outsold Ford in the USA. Honda outsold Daimler Chrysler, and the Toyota Camry was the best-selling car in America. Detroit is hanging on by only 2% to its majority of domestic auto sales, and by the end of this year, most analysts predict Toyota will overtake GM as number one in worldwide sales. Ford F-Series pickup truck sales down 43% last month. Ford Explorers down 50%. Ford is talking about selling off parts of itself. GM is talking merger. It's been rough for a long time in Detroit. Now it's rough and radical. Up next on Point, the U.S. auto industry down the tubes or retrenching for a comeback. Joining me first today from Ann Arbor is Micheline Mickey Maynard. She's Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and covers the auto industry. She's author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Mickey Maynard, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
The numbers are looking so wild, we almost don't know what to make of this anymore. How do you describe this moment for the Big Three, if we can even call them that? I read here Jesse Toprak at Edmunds.com saying the whole concept of the Big Three is shattered. Where is this industry standing, Mickey?
Well, I think what we're going to end up is an industry that looks a lot more like Europe. Over in Europe, over the years, there's always been one player that had about 20% of the market, and then the rest had, you know, the good players had between 10 and 20%. You could be successful with less than 10%. That's totally opposite of our market, where together GM, Ford, and Chrysler back in 1960 had 90% of the car market. I really do think that each of what are now being called the Detroit Three are likely to shrink more before this period is over.
90% all those years ago, that's what we think of. What's good for Detroit is good for America. And now headed to something very, very different. Give us some more of these numbers if you'd be good enough, Mickey. I mean, our head was turned last week when Ford announced, I don't know, the biggest or one of the biggest recalls in automotive history. 1.2 million vehicles nationwide being recalled by Ford. What are the indicators that help us understand where this industry stands at the moment?
Well, let me give you a little bit of historic guidance here. I mean, what's happened with the auto industry has kind of paralleled what's happened with baby boomers in this country. And in 1990, when I was covering the auto industry at the beginning for USA Today, mm-hmm. I saw a statistic in a newsletter from J.D. Power and Associates that said half of all boomers at that point, 1990, had never owned a car from Detroit. And you figured that at that point, boomers were just beginning to buy cars in bulk. It was really our parents who were still in control in the car market. So boomers were moving into their prime childbearing years. They're moving into their prime earning years. Some of us younger boomers are still in those years. So our generation was really starting to make its mark in the car market, and the vehicles that we wanted to buy were not, by and large, made by Detroit companies. So as time has moved on, boomers have moved into their prime earning years. They are the ones who've led the shift away from Detroit. And now their children are just getting to the point where they're buying their first vehicles, and many of them have never ridden in anything from Detroit. So they're not familiar with what the Detroit companies have to offer.
So are you blaming this tremendous fall on boomers, on the buyers, or should it be blamed, if we're talking blame, on the people who designed and built and managed these companies and these cars?
There's two things, really, that have gone on. One is the shift in consumer sentiment, which has shown up all across products, not just across automobiles. I mean, look at TVs, look at MP3 players. You know, anything you buy nowadays, very, very few things are manufactured in the United States, or at least to the extent that they were when our parents were growing up. Second, Detroit is still paying for two things: its quality problems and its image as a gas-guzzling industry. I think they've really licked the quality problems. I think their vehicles built today are better than they ever have been, but people have long memories. They remember paying for vehicles back in the 80s and 90s that they had to take into the shop a week after they bought them, or they owned them and there was a rattle in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And Detroit also really never responded to the gas shocks of the 1970s and the early 1980s, nor are they really responding in any meaningful ways to what's going on right now. If you look at what Detroit is touting at the moment, they're talking about their cars, but GM, Ford, and Chrysler all still have lineups predominantly made up of pickups and SUVs.
And those just aren't selling. We see the huge declines in sales on that front. Help us explain some of the strategy going on here. We're hearing about pieces of these big companies that may be sold, new mergers. First on Ford. I mean, they own lots of brands that aren't Ford, Jaguar, Land Rover, Volvo, Aston Martin, a big chunk of Mazda. Is Ford going to sell part of itself?
It's very possible. They've hired an investment banker to do what's called a strategic assessment, and that basically means looking at all these brands and deciding, you know, what can we really afford to keep, and what should we jettison? And I believe there would be buyers if Ford wanted to sell Jaguar, Land Rover, Aston Martin, some of those European brands. There are investors in Russia and Korea and other places, China, that would love to get their hands on these brands and use them to build their credibility in the car market. So Ford's not going to have any trouble, I don't think, selling those companies. What Ford has to decide is essentially what it wants to be and what it wants to pay attention to.
Is that a turnaround strategy or is that a downsizing strategy?
It's a little bit of both. They call it the way forward, and they're calling it a turnaround strategy, but I think what Detroit is finally coming to grips with is the fact that it will be a smaller part of the American car market. It can be a smaller part and a healthy part and offer a future to people, but first it's going to have to go through this realization that things will no longer be the way they once were.
Not so much the auto manufacturer, but the corporate chop shop in that case. What about GM? There's talk about merger there. When Chrysler merged with Daimler, it ended up more like a takeover. What's the talk of GM merger about? Where's that headed?
It's actually not a merger. What happened was its largest shareholder, Kurt Kerkorian, billionaire, essentially had a dinner with Carlos Ghosn, who is the CEO at both Renault and Nissan,
right,
and suggested that he get together with GM CEO Rick Wagner and look at what's an alliance or some kind of a deal. Well, you know, Mr. Wagner did not cotton very well to the idea of Mr. Ghosn coming in and telling him how to run his business, but you don't say no to your biggest shareholder. So the two companies have put teams together to explore ways that they might have some alliances or projects or engineering development, that kind of thing. It would be, I don't really think there's a possibility of a GM-Renault-Nissan merger, but I think they may have to do some kind of a deal just to keep Mr. Kerkorian at bay.
So it's not a camouflaged step-down, downsize, sell-out, that conversation?
I don't think that's what this is about. I think GM is the same boat as Ford, where GM has to decide, okay, if we're not going to dominate the American car market the way we used to, can we make money? Can we keep our shareholders, including Mr. Kerkorian, happy at, say, 20 to 24% of the market versus 30 to 35%? Mm-hmm. And that's just a fundamental decision that they have to make, whether it's time to just stop acting like the 400-pound gorilla and be maybe a healthy 200-pound gorilla.
Wow, down and down the numbers go. Mickey Maynard, please stand by in Michigan. I want to turn to Pawleys Island, South Carolina, where we're joined by Peter Morici. He's professor of logistics, business, and public policy at the University of Maryland School of Business, former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Peter Morici, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're being painted a picture of the American auto industry, once mighty, ending up something more like Europe's. Is this a calamity? Is this just evolution we should get used to? How do you look at it?
Well, the way it's important to remember that the Americans will continue to make cars for a very long time. The question is how many of those cars will be made by transplant companies, the Japanese, the Koreans, and others, and how many will be made by what was once the Big Three. The Big Three really does suffer from fundamental structural problems, which shows up in their vehicle lineup. While their quality has improved, it still lags Toyota. If you look at five-year durability, when people are making decisions about buying their next car, it's not as favorable as the Japanese yet. They're better, but they're not there yet. Also, they're poorly positioned in their brands. Ford and General Motors are constantly realigning, but you know, when you talk about the generational shifts that Mickey mentioned, consider what Toyota did with the Scion brand. They reinvented themselves for the children of the baby boomers, created a whole brand for them to get them to buy into the ladder of Toyota products. We just don't see General Motors or Ford doing that. I mean, General Motors now is talking about shifting its vehicle lineup to crossover SUVs. Well, golly, I mean, Toyota, Nissan, and the others have been there for, you know, 5 to 10 years. Where have they been? They've been absent. Their labor costs are terribly high. And that goes far beyond the legacy costs. It has to do with the way the contracts are structured, the work rules, and so forth. I mean, General Motors in a plant in Texas is going to be laboring at a $40 an hour disadvantage vis-a-vis a Toyota plant that's going in. I mean, can they be that much better than Toyota so that they can put enough content into the product? Can they be that much more efficient? You know, I don't think so.
What's your attitude toward this? Is this, should we just hit the snooze button and roll over and on the evolution goes, or is this a big problem for the United States?
It is a problem in the sense that when the Japanese build cars here, they use fewer parts, they use less American steel and components and so forth. So it does reduce the U.S. industrial base. It's not good for the economy to be going in this direction. It would be better if Ford and General Motors were more productive.
I mean, would be better. You know, there was a time when this was everything. Mickey, do you see the American industrial, continent such as it is these days, just getting used to this idea?
Well, actually, we really have what are two auto industries. You know, we have this auto industry that's the Detroit 3, as they're starting to be called.
Not the big, but the Detroit.
Not the big, but or the D3, you know, like the MC5.
Okay.
But you have this sort of big six idea now, really, that you have six players. And honestly, if Toyota's number two, Honda's number three, and Nissan's number five, you know, there's your players right there.
We've been joined by Peter Morisi from the University of Maryland School of Business and by Mickey Maynard. She covers the auto industry from Detroit for the New York Times. Right now, Pete is calling from Lebanon, Tennessee. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Pete?
Well, I'm 58 years old, was brought up with a car, owned one since I was 14 years old, and primarily owned General Motors. But in the last 10 years, I have three daughters, all grown and married. I've seen each one of them gradually drift away from American, from the top three, or the big three, or whatever
mm-hmm.
you want to call them,
mm-hmm.
and buy American, but buy Toyota, Nissan, or something.
You've got a big plant in Smyrna, Tennessee, but it's
yes.
not an American brand on it.
But the reason I think that this is happening, back a few years ago, I bought a Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
It had a design flaw in it that Cadillac knew about, but yet still put that new engine out. 30,000 miles later, I had to take it in and fight with them to fix the engine that they knew was having a problem.
Would you rather see your kids buying American cars, Pete?
Well, as my three daughters inform me, we are buying American. But yeah, but I think Chrysler and Chevrolet and everything over the years quit listening to their dealers, quit listening to their buyers and to the public, and just gave us what they wanted. And if it was junk, it was junk.
Pete, we've got it. Peter Morisi. How do you see this over time? I mean,
the caller's story sure resonates with me. My last GM car was a 78 Buick. It had a quadra-barrel carburetor that didn't function properly for a year and a half till they straightened it out, and it blew a head gasket at 18,000 miles, which cost me 10% of its original purchase price to fix.
Mm.
I mean, you know, that's the story of buying General Motors cars in the old days. More recently, we had Cadillacs that burned oil. Now, they're doing better, but the hard reality is, cars are expensive. Young people need to consider the economics of a vehicle. Toyota provides them with vehicles that are more functional, that brake less. So over a 5, 6, 7 year period, which is how long people own cars, they're a better value.
But here's my question, Professor. The auto industry is now a century old, but it's also the future. We're always going to need transportation. This isn't like some clunky old industry. It's an evolving industry. What does
That's
it mean
true.
For American industry and the economy if we can't get out front in a fundamental piece of the manufacturing sort of era in any age, transportation?
I agree. Automobiles use a lot of cutting-edge technology, semiconductors, innovations in engine technology and so forth. And Toyota does a lot of that innovating back home in Japan. They use, when you buy a Japanese car in the United States, it has many more Japanese components in it. It has Japanese R&D in it. We'd get a lot more out of the car industry in terms of building our industrial base if General Motors and Ford was simply more competent. But they're reluctant to do the things they need to do to be more competitive. The first thing is to negotiate with their union and come up with a compensation package that is generous but competitive with Toyota and Nissan. They're unwilling to face that problem. And the second thing is they have to become a heck of a lot more nimble. They're very slow to market with products that people want. As I said earlier, they're just getting into crossover SUVs.
But it seems a little late for this conversation. These are things we've known for years. Alan's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been in the import auto business for a number of years, so I have a lot of perspective from both sides of the pond.
And you've got a dog in this fight. You sell imported automobiles.
No, I do not.
Oh.
I'm in the international automotive business, but I don't sell cars.
Okay. No. That's mysterious, but we'll take it.
What we have seen over the last 30 years in this business is Detroit refusing to accept any of the really good products that they sell overseas under their own names or other names, i.e., for GM would be Opel and Ford of Europe. But those good products and innovations, when they try to come over here, they're either stopped at some level of management within the companies or watered down to the point where they become almost unsellable or undrivable.
What do you make of that? Why wouldn't they bring their best technology and design to this market?
That's something you have to ask your guests. But it is in grapevine, so to speak, it is a refusal in upper management levels to accept the fact that maybe their own people in other countries do a better job of design and research.
Mickey Maynard, let me put it to you then. What about it? Are the one-time big three, now the whatever you want to call the modest three, are they hiding great cars overseas?
Let me address that a little bit, because I think that's a commonly raised question, and it's something that's being raised right now at Ford Motor Company, because this last year, Honda, Toyota, Nissan, and even Chrysler have introduced new subcompact cars, and this is a time when the car market is literally on fire with gas prices over $3 a gallon. There's been a 4-point market share shift from trucks to cars.
Mm-hmm.
That is a tremendous
huge
development given all the pickup trucks and SUVs we've all bought in the last 15 years.
Mm.
Ford does not have a small car in that segment, even though it sells them in Brazil, it sells them in Asia, and it sells them in Europe. And Mark Fields, who's the president of Ford's Americas operations, said last night in Michigan that I won't bring one over just to bring one over. We don't want to sell an Econo box. We want to have something appropriate for the American market. Well, Honda and Toyota and Nissan are selling something appropriate for the American market. It's also been appropriate for the Japanese market because their cars have been on sale over there for 2 and 3 years now.
But Econobox, what is that, arrogance speaking? Or
I'm not 100% sure what it is, but let me just give you a little bit of insight. One of the issues is that they can sell those vehicles in Europe for about 25% more than they could charge in the United States.
Why?
Because car prices are naturally higher in Europe. There are smaller cars sold there than we have in the United States, but they sell for roughly the same price.
Is that because of tariffs that keep prices high on Asian cars?
It's tariffs. It's different prices in different markets. It's just the market over there was never as egalitarian as it was here. Incentives are not as big a deal as they are here. So you don't have as much discounting as we've always had. Bottom line is, if they brought those cars over here, they'd have to cut the price 25%. They wouldn't make any money on them, and then they might have to discount them. So, you know, I did a story recently for the Times, and it turns out that one pickup truck equals the revenue of 10 subcompact cars. So they essentially don't, you know, they're being pulled away from pickups and SUVs kicking and screaming. They know they have to sell more cars because that's what Americans want. But when they look at the numbers, it doesn't make any financial sense.
Let me take a caller from Detroit. Joel's on the line. Hi, Joel. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing, guys?
We're all right. How about your industry out there, Joel?
Well, with the employment hovering around 11%, it's not comforting. But personally, I've been listening to this whole thing, and I went to college in Denmark, and the lady is right. Cars are much more expensive in Europe than here. But I think one of the major things that I learned as well was that within Detroit, most of the companies go to brand their products. Like, look at Ford. They've got, say, Jaguar. but they fail to market Jaguar independently like Toyota did with Lexus. So if someone gets angry at Ford, they're going to get angry at every one of them. Everyone, whether it's a Jaguar or it's any model.
So just buying a lot of brands isn't going to save their bacon here. Joel, we've got it. I want to turn to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Walter McManus. He's director of automotive analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. He was executive director of forecasting with J.D. Power and Associates. Walter McManus, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
You know, we're not experts here, but looking at the flock of stories lately, it's kind of dismaying, even after all these decades of decline in the American auto industry. How do you describe the point it's at? Is Ford for real when they say, you know, the way forward, they got a turnaround going on, or are we devolving into something kind of slight and pitiful?
Well, you know, I mean, if Ford had been walking the talk that Bill Ford talked for the last decade, they would not be in the situation they are. You know, so this way, or they wouldn't need a way forward. They'd be on the way with more fuel-efficient vehicles, more cars, and you know, they are talking the talk, but they didn't walk it all those years. On the other hand, you know, GM, I don't know. They just don't seem to get it. There was a story today in USA Today that Rick Wagoner says he doesn't fear $4 pump prices. And, you know, I've spent the last couple of years of documenting how devastating the high fuel prices, and, you know, $3 has only been recently that it's been above that, have been for the industry. And it started back in 2001. And the industry had signals that the market was shifting away from larger SUVs and what I call the discretionary pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people have to have them. Many people, it's discretionary. We had signals in the industry that people were shifting away as far back as 2001. Instead of dealing with that, they went ahead with their new product programs. So, you know, when you were asking earlier in the program, what's to blame? All of the above. But I think a lot of it is management cluelessness about what people really want. At the same time that they're telling everyone we're giving customers what they want, they aren't.
Peter Morici, how do you see this? I mean, we're looking at the situation now where Ford has a market capitalization, a value in the market of $13 billion. Toyota's is $170 billion. It just dwarfs the Ford Motor Company. Is that Bill Ford's fault? Is it, you know, have we had lousy management? And why should we have bad management in the American auto industry? Why?
Well, we've had very poor management at Ford and General Motors, but right now Ford is worse off. Unfortunately, the Ford family, with less than 5% of the shares, Mickey would know the exact number, controls the company, and they can put one of their heirs in place, which means they get to choose between a very small number of cousins to pick a CEO. Frankly, it's like the crown heads of Europe. It's absurd that a company that size is being managed by an heir who really, his heart wasn't in it when he took the job, didn't really prepare himself to be CEO, and is now making a hash of things. We've seen his best shot at realigning the company. He talks about how, well, the cars have come on us quicker than we thought. He has introduced a whole new line of cars, from the Focus to the 500, mm-hmm. to this now new group of cars, the Fusion on up to the Zephyr, and they struck out. They're decent cars, but they don't catch people's imagination. Mark Fields and Ann Stevens, I believe, don't have it. And
they are Mark Fields and Ann Stevens. What are their positions now?
They're the people that report directly to him and run the company.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen their best shot. They don't provide imaginative designs. They're not providing cars that people want to buy. And they're decent cars, but they don't get a very good price.
But you're saying this is because Ford, in its case, is a family affair? I mean, why shouldn't American society, the American market, bring great executives to the helm here?
Well, the family controls the company, and they decide who manages it. It's that simple. Even when before Mr. Ford, and we had an outside CEO, he had to meet quarterly with Bill's aunts and uncles to discuss his plans for the company. This thing is being run like the Detroit Lions, which is a family hobby.
But what about the union side of this? You've said that only Queen Elizabeth gets better benefits than American Automotive Union workers. Do they have a hand? Is it their fault? Is that the right word? Or how do you see
it? Bill Ford has been reluctant to take on the issue of excessive compensation in his industry. He's really a very decent guy who has a lot of empathy for the line workers. But unfortunately, if you pay them $81 an hour in total compensation package while the other guy's paying $40 and you can't compete and you go out of business, what good have you done? You know, when the Canadian UAW, I think it was last year, came up for its contract renewal, they picked Ford for a reason. Bill Ford's a soft touch. That said, you don't hear Rick Wagoner talking about renegotiating the contract in a big way. I expect next year when it comes up, there are going to be some changes. It's going to look like the early days of the airlines where they cut off a piece of the tail, but they don't get enough done. And until they do, until they get that contract in alignment with what Toyota pays, they can't be enough better than those people, and they're not even as good as them, to compete. In the end, they can't put enough content in the product. They can't make it attractive enough. That's why they can't produce an Econobox that's attractive. Toyota's doing with the Yaris. They brought in a $14,000 automatic transmission car.
Yep, and Ford can't do it, and GM's not quite doing it either. Judy's calling from Panama City, Florida. Hi, Judy. What do you see?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You see all the car commercials, and they make such a big deal about the dependability and the crash test ratings and the mileage and all.
Yeah.
And I bought my car 3 years ago. I bought a Dodge. I bought American. But, you know, when I was shopping, I didn't look at any of that, and I didn't even look at mileage. I have three kids that I have to haul around, so I knew I needed a big car, three big boys.
Yep.
And so I didn't look at mileage. And to be frank, I didn't even look at the safety rating.
What did you look at, Judy?
Well, I looked at SUVs because this was 3 years ago.
It was cheap.
And I ended up buying a big V8 Dodge Durango. And here's why. Because the air conditioning blows cold right away, because it came in a color that I wanted, and because it drives more like a car where the other SUVs drove like a truck.
And the Durango is also pretty kind of hot, aggressive looking. Did the design matter to you?
Yes, it did. I'm a woman, so yes, I wanted my car to look nice. And it didn't look like a truck, and, you know, I didn't want a minivan. And so I think, you know, we talk about how the imported cars are more dependable and they don't break down as often, and that's important. But I bet there are a lot of Americans that don't really take that into consideration, that they're looking for a car that looks nice and has a good cold air conditioner and, you know, other things.
Maybe so. Let us pick it up. Mickey Maynard, what about the design element? I'm reading here about people warning about a brain drain, that the best design is going on overseas today. Is that seen as a problem in Detroit?
Well, let me just back up to what the caller was saying, because I don't think she's typical at all of the way Americans shop for cars anymore.
Hmm.
I think Americans are the smartest that they've ever been when they go car shopping. They spend hours on the Internet. You can get all kinds of information about quality, insurance, ratings, design elements, other features on the Internet if you go to sites like Edmunds.com,
right,
Cars.com. I mean, I think people are walking into showrooms smarter than the people that are selling cars, to be honest, and I think that's a real challenge for Detroit.
I want to turn right now to White Bear Lake, Minnesota. Paul Rubin joins us. He's owner of White Bear Lake GMC, the dealership, one of the largest dealerships in Minnesota. He is co-chair of the GM National Dealer Council, which represents 7,700 dealerships. Paul Rubin, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, real good to be with you, Tom.
So here we're hearing all this talk of woe and change out of Detroit. People saying it's not the big three anymore. Toyota may overtake your outfit. GM is the world's number one provider of supplier of cars this year. Are you tearing your hair out? How do you see this? You're a dealer.
Well, I'm a little bit more on the inside because we attend these meetings and get to see what's in the plans and so on. You know, the truth is that I disagree with just about everything that your guests have said this morning.
You think GM is on a roll? It's going to be a winner? How do you see it, Mr. Rubin?
Well, close to a third of the cars that are sold in the United States, cars and trucks, are General Motors cars. So to say that they're not selling cars and that they aren't interesting and so on, it's just not true.
Yeah, they're selling, but that portion, that market share has drifted down and down and down.
Well, don't you think it makes sense that a market share might go down when you have many, many more competitors coming into the field? For instance, a new Nissan pickup truck, which of course happens to get less gas mileage than General Motors pickup trucks because they are the industry leader in gas mileage. So these are things that at least your guests must not be aware of, but there in fact is the case that General Motors sells more pickups than anybody else and that they have the best gas mileage and are class leaders in their gas mileage.
So when you get together with your thousands of other dealers, and you're the co-chair of GM National Dealer Council, what's the mood there? I mean, are people upbeat? Do they think like the future is in the palm of their hand or something else?
Well, I think it's the same as any other American. You sit there and you look at gas prices going up. You see a war in the Middle East. There, we have other concerns other than just our dealerships. We of course we're concerned, but we are seeing some significant winners. General Motors builds more cars that get over 30 miles to the gallon than any car manufacturer that's selling in the United States. We lead in gasoline class in almost everything. The idea that the quality is not as good is no longer the case. In many cases, we're industry leaders in quality in the models. And the people that, you know, I was listening to just either don't do their homework or just refuse to look at that, because you can sit and knock and say that the imports build a better car. It just doesn't happen to be true anymore in a lot of cases.
Paul Rubin, stand by for a minute. Peter Morici, how about it? Paul's co-chair of the National Dealer Council for GM here, and he's still in the ring and swinging, saying you got too much gloom and doom in your front windshield.
Well, this is an example of why General Motors can't be turned around. It's a culture of entitlement and it's a culture of denial. Of course they have higher gas mileage, make more cars with higher gas mileage because they just make many more cars. It has to do with percentages. General Motors, Cadillac lags Toyota in quality, Cadillac lags Lexus in quality, Chevrolet lags Toyota. General Motors has to fess up to that, do something about it, make better vehicles. You know, it's not people like Mickey and I that decide the choices that consumers make. It's consumers with the experiences they have with vehicles, going to the showroom.
But Paul Rubin says, look, they're still selling 30% of the cars in the country. How bad is that?
Well, the percentage keeps going down every year. I know about one thing that's certain every year. I get a year older, and General Motors' market share goes down 0.5 percentage point to 1%. That's been going on for 20 years. It's inexorable. Eventually, General Motors will be down to zero if they continue with this posture.
What do you say, Paul?
I think it's absurd that those are absurd statements by somebody that doesn't know what they're talking about, or is just negative to General Motors for no reason.
Are your salespeople
statements? We have a new Solstice, which is the hottest car in the United States. We have a new Impala, which is leading in its class. All the new intros. I wouldn't argue the case that our old and outdated models that are slowly disappearing. Don't sell as well as that I would like them to sell, but the new vehicles that are coming online, the new full-size SUVs that get much better gas mileage than the old ones and are industry leaders in just about every category, as the new product comes on, I can't speak for Ford and Chrysler, as the new product comes on for General Motors, we have had great success in each of these new launches in the last couple of years.
We hear it. You're still slugging. Paul Rubin, owner of White Bear Lake GMC in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and co-chair of the GM National Dealer Council. Mr. Rubin, we wish you luck on the lot. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let me turn to Stephen, calling from Boston. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Good morning. I wondered what your guests thought about the overcapacity in the market due to the fact that Chrysler was not allowed to go out of business, but instead bailed out for the taxpayers.
That's a ways back now, but there it was. We'll pick it up. Walter McManus, how about it? Did the government create overcapacity that's now hurting American automakers? And I guess this, do you see the government stepping in here at any point in the future to bail out one or more of these automakers?
Well, I don't see it happening, at least not the current Congress stepping in. I think that they've made it clear, and the president has made it clear that we're on our own in the auto industry. But I would say that look back at what actually happened with Chrysler, they paid back their loans ahead of time, and so we, you know, everyone got their money back. It was not a bailout. It did not cost us a dime because we all got our money back. And in terms of overcapacity, I mean, what caused the overcapacity is the transplants. I mean, you know, we are still making about the same number of vehicles in North America that we did 10, 15 years ago. It's just that now they're being badged Honda and Toyota and Nissan, and now, you know, Hyundai and others are coming in. And we've shifted capacity. Now, the big three would probably love to have been able to open new plants in the South without unions, but they had obligations, and they also have, in order to keep the commitments they have to the workers, they have to keep employing them here in the Midwest. And, you know, they can't just cut and run. And the they tried a strategy in the 70s of moving to the South. That didn't work for them. But as we introduce new plants, each new plant that comes in, basically there's a plant that closes, and the ripple effect, you know, even though, you know, they can say they're made in America, The content, the domestic content for the big three is still much higher than for Toyota, Honda, Nissan.
That is a very big point, if I can jump in.
Peter Morici, please.
That is a very important point about why we should care about these companies and why we want to see them turned around. The automobile industry is a huge consumer of semiconductors, microprocessors, software, lots of high-tech thinking, and we want to see them succeed, so that work will be here. Also, the Japanese and Koreans can bring in components from Asia, where often they benefit from subsidies or protected markets and other unfair trading practices. The sad thing, though, is General Motors, instead of complaining as loudly as it should about that, is happily running off to China to make parts there to bring back into the United States so it can take advantage of the subsidies and undervalued yuan and so forth. But, I mean, we really ought to care about what this gentleman just talked about.
Yeah, well, we hear it. Mickey Maynard, let me ask you. Ford, of course, lost $1.5 billion in North America last year. $1.6 billion. In January, they came out with the Way Forward. Said they'd cut 30,000 jobs and close 14 plants by 2012. Now they're saying they're going to accelerate and expand that program. More steps, presumably quicker, cutbacks within 60 days. Is there a floor here? Do you see small as healthy, or is small a problem?
Well, unfortunately for Ford, things are going to get a lot worse for them than before they get better, because we said in a story last week that they have a worst-case forecast inside the company that they could lose as much as $5 billion this year in North America. So I think we're in for another couple of years of this spiral. You know, Chrysler is starting to teeter a little bit again, too. They did make a profit in the second quarter, but now they're saying they'll probably lose $600 million in the third quarter. And I don't mean to laugh. This is very serious business. But, you know, by contrast, Toyota came out with its results last week, and it earned $2 billion on its American operations. Nissan is making money on its American operations, and so is Honda. So, you know, there really is a very healthy American auto industry. It's just not run by the Detroit Three.
Peter Morici, I want to ask you, we just heard at the top of the hour, you know, in the voting yesterday in primaries in Michigan, in the 7th District, that's Battle Creek and Lansing and Jackson, there, Joe Schwartz lost to Tim Walberg in the GOP. Tim Walberg, more conservative, Joe, more moderate. And we heard in his concession speech, he was saying, you know, the politics we've got going on in this country aren't good for American competitiveness. Do you see a public policy link here at all, a political link?
Oh, yes,
link?
I do.
What is it? What?
Yeah, the Bush administration hasn't been tough enough at all on the Chinese, the Koreans, the Japanese with regard to the value of their currency. The Koreans have made some progress. But the American manufacturers do have to compete with products from Asia that benefit from, you know, undervalued currencies. That's a major, major problem. Also, Korea and China are loaded with subsidies of various kinds, and that makes it tougher to make parts here to use in American cars, and the Japanese do use more Asian parts than we do. So, you know, there is a public policy problem here. The president is agnostic, and he doesn't seem to want to do very much about it. I'm afraid we're not going to get much of a change until we get another White House, because we've had three Treasury secretaries in a row that just don't seem to want to do anything about the problem.
Walter McManus, you're there in Michigan. When it comes to policy, Peter Morici points to subsidies. Is that it on the competitiveness front, or are there bigger issues that intersect with politics and public policy?
Well, you know, we spend a lot of money now with all giving incentives to people to buy fuel-efficient vehicles that are made overseas. And so, if this is a new technology that we want to have here so that we employ people and we have the technology of the future, giving money to people who buy a Lexus sport utility just doesn't make any sense to me. We have no supply chain in the U.S. to support those kinds of vehicles. Now, there are companies that could do it, but today the supply chain doesn't exist. Some kind of investment credit for the suppliers, who are the ones who are actually going to develop and build these systems, would make a lot more sense. And that would be true with all of the new technologies. I mean, the car companies do not invent every technology they use. They are getting everything from suppliers. So, and that's why when I was talking about the content, the North American content of the big three is still close to, well over 90%, whereas the Japanese transplants, it's more like 40%. But because their suppliers moved over here, they can claim all of that as domestic, even though the supplier is the one doing the importing.
And it makes a difference to American jobs.
Exactly.
And American profits. I want to get one more call, if I may, from Chicota, Oklahoma. Fid's on the line. Hi, Fid, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment that I deliver parts to the GM plants all the way from Michigan to Laredo, where they take them into Mexico to make trucks.
Yes.
Stuff.
What do you see?
Well, my interaction with the UAW is that they are very well paid and very underproducing in what they do. They seem to have a very cavalier attitude towards their jobs. It makes my job a lot harder because I end up waiting for hours and hours just to deliver to them, and I just don't see how that can be competitive in the auto market when the Japanese are doing a lot more efficient job.
Fid, let us look at that. And thanks very much for your call in Oklahoma, Mickey. What about the labor part of this equation? Cavalier attitude, Fid says, from the front lines.
Well, I covered the UAW convention in Las Vegas in June, and I think the UAW is very concerned about what's going to happen to the industry and what's going to happen to it as an institution in the industry, because their futures are intertwined. So far, the UAW had played this until last year in sort of a defensive policy that we have a contract until 2007 and, mm-hmm. We're not changing our contract. Little by little, they've been giving in on some issues such as health care. They've managed to protect their members at Delphi, gotten buyouts for the GM members. But those contract negotiations next year could tell the story of where Detroit is headed, because, I said in my book a couple of years ago that what they really need to do is tear up the contract and rewrite it to reflect the conditions that they're working under now. And what the UAW needs to recognize is the fact that those Toyota and Honda plants, they don't have a contract. So, you're taking a contract the size of the Manhattan phone book and comparing it with nothing. And the point is, even if they shrink to, say, the size of the Ann Arbor phone book, they still have a ways to go to get to nothing. But they need to rethink the way they do business, because it is not going to work as we go forward.
Mm. Peter Morici, last word goes to you. If we lose here, if we get downsized to I don't know what, do we lose more? Does that wave, is it a wave that goes into other industries?
America becomes a lot poorer. We do a lot less research and development when we buy Japanese cars, even if they're made here, than we do in the United States. The U.S. economy will grow more slowly. The American economy is the loser for the decline of Ford and General Motors.
And off it goes. I'm grateful to all three of you for being with us today. Peter Morici at the University of Maryland School of Business, former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Peter, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Mickey Maynard, author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Mickey, always great speaking with you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
And Walter McManus, joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Director of the Automotive Analysis at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. Walter McManus, thank you for being here.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.